Joining us now is Fred Pohl, a man who has been a major figure in science fiction for more years than we probably want to count.
Well over a year.
Well over a year. Okay. For a newcomer, you've really had an impact on the field.
Well, I began reading science fiction when I was at 10. I began being active, or as active as I could at the time, in science fiction fandom when I was 12 or 13. I began trying to write when I was 13 and a half. And I discovered from meeting people like Don Wolheim and others who were much more sophisticated than I, that when you wrote a story, what you did with it was mail it to an editor.
You hadn't quite caught on to that part.
I hadn't figured that out. So I began doing that, or actually not so much mailing. I lived in Brooklyn, and the offices of the editors were all in New York. And it was cheaper for me to put a nickel in a subway slot than to put postage on a manuscript. I dropped the stories off, which let me meet some of the editors and pester them. And some of them were, for no particular reason, nice to me. But when I was 15, I wrote a poem. And Amazing Stories accepted it when I was 16. And they published it when I was 17 and paid for it when I was 18. So at some point, it became a sort of a pro.
I see they paid rapidly.
Not too rapidly. They didn't want to get you too excited. You
know. Oh. So that was your first publication?
That was my first
poem.
Paid publication, yeah. I'd been writing and publishing fan magazines before that, which I thought would enable me to learn how to edit a professional magazine. And through no great virtue of my own, I had the opportunity to do that. Popular Publications, one of the big pulp houses of the time, had decided to bring out a cut-rate group of magazines paying a half a cent a word instead of the penny that the others were, you know, just throwing to the writers. So I went over and I talked to the editor-in-chief, a man named Rogers Terrell, and he hired me, and I became a professional science fiction editor at the age of 19.
And you hadn't sold any science fiction stories, just the poem?
Had I sold? Yes, I think I'd sold one. No, I'd sold half a story to John Campbell for Astounding.
Was it the first half
or
second half?
It was a collaboration.
Oh.
Actually, it was the second half. It was written by a man named Milton A. Rothman, who is a friend of mine, and he had very good ideas, but not a lot of literary skill, so I rewrote it, and we sold it to John. That was my first actual fiction sale. My conscience ultimately began to bother me, and I gave my half of it back to Milt some years before he died. It was still getting reprinted here and there. It was a story called Heavy Planet, which was about, well, you can figure out what it was about.
So at 19, you became an editor?
Became an editor.
And what magazine again?
Two magazines nobody since has ever heard of and did not thrive at the time. One was called Astonishing Stories. The other was called Super Science Stories. Astonishing Stories was 112 pages, and we were selling it for a dime. Super Science Stories was the heavyweight. It was, I think, 160 pages or so, and we sold it for 15 cents. But not very many of them. They survived for a few years. But
yeah. I mean, I remember the titles. If for nothing else, an Astonishing Story sounded like they were trying to sort of sound like Amazing, sort of sound like Astounding.
Yeah, well, that's right.
It's interesting because you mentioned that, you know, most of the magazines were paying a penny a word.
I wouldn't say most of the magazines were paying a penny a word. In the 30s, there were basically three magazines.
Okay.
There was Astounding, which paid a penny and sometimes more a word.
Uh-huh.
It was owned by Street and Smith, or before that by Clayton, but both of them were well-financed pulp companies until Clayton went broke, but that's a separate story. The other magazines were Amazing Stories and Wonder Stories. Amazing and Wonder paid about a half a cent, okay. And they paid on publication.
Okay.
And sometimes, in the case of Wonder Stories, hardly at all. As is generally said of Wonder Stories, that they paid promptly on lawsuit, which was pretty close to true.
Oh, but in talking with Hal Clement earlier, he was pointing out that even at a penny a word, you could actually earn a living wage. That he said when he sold his first couple of stories, he made enough money to pay for half a year's tuition in college.
I guess that depends on what you call living wage.
Yeah, well, there is always that.
I figured out the math of it one time. In the mid-30s, there were about 20 or 25 regular science fiction writers who appeared fairly often, at least three or four times a year, and a few others that didn't really count, a number of others who would have maybe one story. And I figured out that the average income for each of them was about between $20 and $50 a month.
Oh.
Now, you could live on $50 a month if you had to, but you would not be eating caviar very often.
Yeah. So even then, the pay was low.
Oh, yes. It's not quite that low now. The magazines don't pay very well, but some of the books pay quite well.
Uh-huh.
Some don't, too. But
yeah.
if you're lucky and the book sells well, you can make $100,000 or more per book.
That's a livable wage.
You can live on it.
Yeah.
What you do, you don't make it necessarily out of the first book publication, but American science fiction is a very exportable commodity. Most of my books are published in at least a dozen languages, and some of them more than that. I recently signed contracts for my first Greek edition of anything.
Thinking of the foreign editions, is there any constant thread in terms of what types of books sell well in what types of countries?
No, I think that if it sells well in America, the other country publishers will take a shot on it, whether they know anything about the book itself or not. They just assume that science fiction readers are very similar all over the world, and I think that's a good assumption. I mean, I've traveled in a lot of countries, and I've run into people who had different skin color and definitely different languages, but turned out to be quite a lot like American science fiction readers. My wife and I went to a Japanese science fiction convention some years ago, and in many ways it was very like the American science fiction convention of the sort we're at here. But there were some differences. Every one of the guests was issued a geisha girl. They weren't actually full-time geishas, but they were female fans who had had geisha training, and they were very, very nice. Mine kept me company in all the room parties and kept me from getting into serious trouble. My wife was with me, too, so I wasn't going to get into extremely serious trouble. But in one of the room parties, she and I were talking, and she mentioned that her 10 or 20 generation back ancestor was a famous Japanese who had been so famous that when he died, he was made into a god. And one of the other fans in the room came running across the room and said, "I prayed to him before my final exams, and I passed."
Yes,
you don't get that at these cons.
No, no. That's definitely a cultural difference. So your geisha was the great-great-granddaughter of a god.
That's right, yeah.
Though there are some people that think they're gods as they walk the earth. But
yes,
you know,
I've noticed that.
But that's another story.
They're not officially validated.
Right. Now, at 19, you were editing science fiction magazines, two science fiction magazines.
Right. Well, they were bimonthly, so it came to one per month.
Okay. So you got one company publishing two science fiction magazines. Why would they do that instead of just do one every month?
They wanted to have as much exposure as they could. A bimonthly magazine could hope to stay on the stands for 2 months. It didn't always work because the dealers got tired of looking at them and they shipped them back. But the longer you can leave a publication on the newsstand, the more sales you're going to get incrementally. You get maybe half of them in the first few days, but then the longer it's there, the more people are going to buy it, which is why it is really tough to be a book publisher, a paperback book publisher these days, hardcover too, but paperback particularly, because there's so much competition for shelf space that really you have about 8 days to have your book out there. And if it hasn't sold in the 8 days, it's going to come back to you. This is not counting the books by writers that the dealers know enough to know that somebody's going to buy them sooner or later.
Yeah.
But if you're a new writer published in a paperback, you have 8 days to make your case. And if you don't do it then, you're history.
Oh, God.
Yes, isn't it?
It's insanity.
Yeah, well, it is silly. It's ridiculous, but there it is.
You know, at some level, if general bookstores do that, then they deserve to get whacked by Amazon.com and the other, you know, non-traditional booksellers of the world.
Yeah, except that Amazon whacks a few writers as it goes along, because they have this bad habit of selling second-hand copies along with the new ones, and that's...
Ow.
doesn't make much difference to them, but it makes a tremendous difference to the writer, because he didn't get anything for the second-hand copy.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. They offer, you can buy the book for this price or buy a used edition for that price.
And then you have to ponder, do I want to spend more or less for the book? Gee, I don't know.
And I think most readers, or many readers, don't realize that buying used books doesn't do anything for the author.
Yeah, they don't. No, I know this because I signed a lot of books for people who don't realize that, because they show me proudly the books that they have of mine which have been remaindered from some public library.
Oh! Oh, God.
I don't really mind this, you know. I do write for money because I need to have money to live on, and I'm glad to have it. But I also write to be read, and if they can't afford to buy the books new, and if they buy them secondhand, or if they read them in the public library, fine, they're still my friends.
A, they're reading you, but also if they pick up a used book or a remaindered something or whatever, they're likely to then turn around and buy something else of yours. You know, I mean, that's the thing.
Might be so. In fact, when I was first reading science fiction and had no money at all, I bought the magazines in secondhand stores.
Okay.
And what changed me was that there was a serial called The Stone from the Green Star, written by that kid, Jack Williamson, who was just getting started.
Yeah, I wonder, do you think he's going to go anywhere?
He's showing signs. And I read the first installment in a magazine I bought in a secondhand store, and I couldn't wait for the second. And I actually put my quarter down at the newsstand and bought a new copy to see how it came out. And that's...
Yeah.
You said it worked out.
Yeah, it works out. And I also think in some cases, some of the books that are bought remaindered, there are people that had bought the paperback and then decided they wanted the hardbound, and so they found a remaindered copy of the hardbound or something.
I suppose that's true.
You're not getting much out of it, but...
Yeah, I don't really worry a lot about this, Warren. I don't want to. When I was a magazine editor, I had to think about how make money out of it, because the publisher was looking over my shoulder all the time, and I had to figure out ways of getting the magazine distributed and advertised and all that. Now, I don't have to. Somebody else has to.
Somebody else has to worry about that. Well, you know, I heard from Kevin Anderson the other day. They had a really interesting idea on what to do to help sales of one of their books. It's the new Dune prequel, but the Butlerian Jihad. And he and Brian Herbert wrote a short story in that universe. It's a standalone short story, and rather than, you know, publishing it in a magazine, the publisher just bound it up in a little pamphlet advertising the new book, and they printed up umpteen hundreds, thousands of copies, and they're shipping it out to every convention, and they're giving it away, hoping that people read the short story, which sort of leads into the new trilogy of hardbound novels.
Good thing to do, yeah. I've recommended that to one publisher I know. Not in quite that form, but I suggested that he take the first chapter of each of the books he was publishing in the next month or the month after that, bind them up in a little paperback and give that away every month. And I think that it would do pretty well. I'm not sure that he's ever going to do it. But
every once in a while, things like that work amazingly. Sometimes giving things away makes a lot of money. So you're editing two magazines. You got two magazines on the newsstand simultaneously.
Right.
How did you pick which stories would go into which magazine?
I don't know. I just tried to balance each. I didn't consider that they had separate policies. Mm-hmm. One was just thicker than the other, so I could put more into it, but it cost more. So I was glad to find enough I could print to go into the magazines without worrying about which one belonged in which magazine. Later on, when I was editing Galaxy and If, I did try to keep the policies separate.
Uh-huh.
But by then I'd learned a lot more about editing, too.
Yeah.